Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Before beginning to write novels, Michael Agliolo worked with most of the Fortune 500 companies from his home studio in Chico in his career as a photographer. He has a master's degree in photography from Chico State, and he enjoys the freedom that writing permits him, and he has now written his second novel, The 51st Directive. Michael Agliolo, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, this is not your first novel. Your first novel was Last Light, and how was it different?
About as different as you can get. First book was in third person, and again, it was the first book, literally, and it's to put the two together would be apples and oranges. The second book was written in first person from a woman's point of view, and the first book was third person from a photographer's point of view. And so there's a big difference right there.
Well, I was going to ask you where there's overlap between what you know about photography and your expertise as a photographer. And you've taught photography, no?
Yes.
And writing. How do you draw on your experience as a photographer to write novels? Because I have my idea, and it may be not what you have in mind, but what do you see as that overlap?
The creativity part. When I was a photographer, I started off like a lot of folks did, shooting weddings, passports, and all that. I quickly got into commercial photography. And after about 17 years, I got tired of doing what other people wanted me to do, and I became a stock photographer, which allowed me to create anything I wanted, anytime I wanted, and I became an expert in Photoshop. So I was allowed to take an image and change it into anything I wanted. And so my imagery became special effects. And I loved the freedom of going wherever my mind wanted to go. My object was to make one photo a day. And I did that for 10 years. And it became stock photography, which anybody could buy that wanted to use that kind of imagery. Then the writing was even freer. Now I could go wherever I wanted to go without having to deal with gravity, without having to deal with lenses, without having to deal with light even. I was free.
Well, in your book, there's not a single photograph. In your book, there is on the cover.
Right.
And describe the cover for us.
I did create that.
That's what I thought.
Yes. The cover, as you can see, is the Capitol. And there's blood coming
out. In Washington, D.C., that capital.
Washington, D.C., yes. And the little bit of blood that's coming out sort of gives you an indication of what's going on. I made the background red to give you that, as a photographer in me there, saying this is dangerous. And I'll try to bring those things out.
Red is a warning.
Red is
danger.
A warning. And has lots of connotations. The colors do. And the 51st directive is a scary thing. And I didn't know about it. Before I started writing.
Well, now, getting back to the cover, though, you have the words, the, and the number 51st in white. So you've got red with blood dripping down over the surface of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. You've got the 51st in white. The word directive is in red. And then there's the White House with blue light on it.
Mm-hmm.
So we get the idea, red, white, and blue, those are patriotic colors. And then the title, The 51st Directive, and it says it's a novel. And yet, The 51st Directive is fact.
Yes.
And I don't know if other people are like me, but at first when I saw that, I thought, well, I don't know what The 51st Directive is. I looked at your cover and I thought, well, he made this up. And then I turned to the first page in your book and I remembered, now I remember. And it doesn't seem like a very big deal was made of it at the time. It just kind of slipped by our notice, we saying the citizens of the United States. So you have this cover. This is the only photograph which you created yourself for this book in your role as photographer. And since this is the Capitol building, you describe these buildings in Washington, D.C. that you have your characters go to. And they're also your descriptions are so real for me. I'm really in where these characters are going. So I thought maybe that's where your photographer's eye came in, that when you describe the scene, you're seeing it and you're helping us see these buildings, for example, the characters go to.
Good observation. I think you're right. I haven't put myself in that view before, but that's probably true. The red, white, and blue, you caught me completely off guard with, and now I'm going to claim it all the time. You'll also notice on the cover, my name starts off white. Mm-hmm. And turns kind of the same color as the blood.
Mm-hmm. The very bottom of the letters in your name.
And you'll notice I did that before on my other book, too. I know this is radio, but that's just going to be a little bit of a theme for me.
To have one color fading into another.
Yes, and probably the red, because I seem to like that style of creating something dangerous. Mm-hmm. And the other observations you made are pretty interesting, too. That all came from research. Everything that's described is actually the way the Capitol is laid out.
Well, I thought you must have done a tremendous amount of research because of the nature of this book, your newest book. And I assume you've never lived in Washington, D.C. You've never been a part of the FBI or Homeland Security.
I haven't been a woman yet either.
And nor.
Well, not in this lifetime.
This main character. And so I thought you must have done a lot of research when you're writing this book, but it sounds like it would have been fun to do.
That's the whole point of writing for me, is the fun.
And for example, you have your main character say, here's my burner cell phone number. And I thought, burner, now that from the context, I figured, oh, this is like a disposable phone, but I hadn't heard it labeled burner before. I'm maybe the only one. Other people may be familiar with that. But you use a lot of the terminology that these people in these professions would use. So I thought that must have come from research because you didn't from personal experience. So that must have been fun to research. How did you go about that?
Probably it's the way I write. And I imagine you were going to climb into this in a little bit, but it might be important to bring it out now. The books that I've written I pause a little bit because this is pretty – I don't know how unusual this is for writers. I don't know what the next – sentence is going to be, no less the next chapter, no less the end of the book. I start a book with just going, I'm going to start a book today, just like I did with photographs that I created. I'm going to write something today, and I'm going to keep writing, and I'll go back and edit it like I did photos in Photoshop. In this case, Photoshop was probably my imagination. Even the name, the 51st Directive, I did not know what the 51st Directive was.
So I wasn't the only one.
No.
Even though I knew about that event, that thing that happened, but I had not heard it called the 51st Directive. Well, since we're talking about it, would you mind reading? You have on the very first page of your book, because your book is a novel, but you say fact, and you have the symbol, the President of the United States, the eagle, there in the shield, and you say it was a fact that
the National Security and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 51, sometimes simply called Executive Directive 51, created and signed by President of the United States George W. Bush on May 4th, 2007. It's a presidential directive which claims power to execute procedures for the continuity of the federal government in the event of a catastrophic emergency. Such an emergency is considered as any accident, regardless of location, that results in extraordinary levels of mass casualties, damage, or disruption severely affecting the U.S. population, infrastructure, environment, economy, or government functions. The unclassified portion of the directive was posted on the White House website on May 9th, 2007, without further announcement or press briefings.
So this is a pretty important event. And this is my guest, Michael Agliolo, reading from his book, The 51st Directive. And he has just told us what that was, his actual fact. There was a 51st Directive. You say sometimes just called Executive Directive 51. And some of us remember when this happened. This was back in 2007, which is not that long ago. But we never hear about it anymore.
You know, it's on the back of my jacket on the book. It says, the deepest parts of the internet hold the secrets to a world that will never be the same as Homeland Security Presidential Directive 51 overrides every freedom you believe you had when you woke up this morning. The 51st Directive will scare you, should scare you, and no one knows it exists. It does. I didn't know it exists. Like you said, you didn't either. But we live in a world right now where this could happen today, right now, and we would be subject to the rules of the 51st Directive, which is pretty scary because what I describe in here is accurate.
Well, I knew that President Bush created this, but I somehow just slipped off my radar screen. I forgot about it, but it still it could still be called on. It could still be evoked.
You bet.
And the label Directive 51, Executive Directive 51, was something that was new to me, but I knew that this was done. So I just imagine, and I may be totally wrong, that maybe it was in 2007 that this seed was planted in the back of your mind, or only recently you decide, hey, that would make a good novel.
I wish that was how I did it.
How did you do it?
I just started writing. I finished the first book. When I came to this one, I had already started two or three more, got halfway through. And when the next sentence doesn't come, I stop. I just go, if it's not there, it's not supposed to be in a way. I know that sounds a little crazy, but so I was halfway through another book. I stopped, turned my chair around and said, I'm going to do something else. And I want to do something different. How far away can I get from that first book I wrote? And first person and a woman, FBI agent, is about as far away as I could get at the moment. And I said, that's what I'm going to write about. And then the first sentence came out and just kept going till the book is in your hands like it is now. So with that, turns out to be the style. So I didn't know what the 51st Directive was. I didn't think of it until I was probably a third of the way through and I started doing research and I found out I was writing about something that potentially could happen. And one of the things that people should know about the 51st Directive is that it is a presidential directive, and the only person can decide when that directive is over is the president. And he can say, so he decides when it starts and he decides when it's over. And that should scare us a little bit. I'm not trying to scare people, but the scenario I put together in this, pretty far out, I hope is a little bit of a wake-up call.
Well, I would call your book a thriller. Wouldn't you?
That's what I try to make it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because I start reading and right away, I mean, you get right into the action right away. You have a prologue to the 51st Directive. I should have stayed invisible, Brian told himself. I tried. But this is not the main character speaking. So you have third person, somebody named Brian tells himself, I should have stayed invisible. So it's not until we get to chapter one that we meet the protagonist. And she is telling this story in the first person. And
oh, read the first line.
Well, she's a he, yeah. Jake reminded two of his buddies. And this, when she was younger,
yes.
She was already pretty tough.
Yes.
But she's very attractive. And I was amused by the way you get across this idea of when she meets a guy, they notice that she's attractive. And they kind of give her the once over. She sees it in their faces. And so with your permission, in fact, you said I could do so, I was going to read an example of that. So this is the woman's name is?
Erica Brewer.
Erica Brewer. And so Erica had been assigned an attitude readjustment. She refers to attitude readjustment so that she had to move out of her office and she was banished to the mailroom to adjust her attitude.
Yes.
So she had been downgraded, so to speak. And she was
for 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks.
Punishment.
And it was during this time. And she said the chief was saying about 2 hours ago, and this guy stops in mid-sentence and looks at her. And somebody else introduces her and says, this is FBI Agent Brewer, this woman. She's looking into the case I was telling you about. And they specifically are there because there was this fire that was a mystery and they didn't know how it started. And so Agent Brewer says, do you know where the fire started? I ask. In the basement, he replied, glancing at my legs. The fire worked its way up to the first floor, he said, as his eyes moved to my waist. He folded his arms over his chest and took a long look at my second story. Quote, my investigators are looking into it now, should have the answer later today. Finally, looking at my eyes, he concluded, I didn't see any structural damage to the foundation. The building looks good. She says, yeah. I stared at him till he looked away. So that's the way you convey how men react to her when they first meet her. They're impressed with her, the building's structure.
Yes, and, which is the only thing I'm qualified to say from the male point of view, but I tried to find what it was like to be the woman, to being looked at that way. And looked that way all the time. You know, maybe it's the first thing you get from men. I interviewed a lot of women besides my wife on this.
When you were researching this book.
Oh, yeah. I would sit down with anybody that would talk to me and learned all the secrets about women and how they feel about themselves and things that have happened to them.
Well, she takes it in good humor.
Yes.
In fact, I appreciate her sense of humor. As I was reading, I thought, gosh, this woman has a good sense of humor. And so I thought, well, you must have yourself if you come up with these these remarks by Erica.
I can't tell you how much fun that is.
I'll bet. We're going to take a break, and when I come back, Michael Agliolo will tell us more about his thriller that he has written, The 51st Directive. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm here with my guest, Michael Agliolo. He is a photographer, but he has now turned to writing novels. His second novel is The 51st Directive. So, Erica Brewer is an FBI agent who's temporarily sent down to work in the mailroom, but then the situation arises where they need her back as an agent, so she's pulled out of the mailroom.
Mostly because of the letter she found.
Yes. That's what that opening is in the very first of your book, Somebody Named Brian That We Don't Know.
That's right.
Well, what is in that letter?
Well, the first line of that letter is, I am dead.
Now, that's an attention getter right there. Here's this guy, and you reproduce it in your book as if it is in handwriting, in script. And she gets this letter, and the first sentence is, I am dead. The first attack will occur Thursday the 24th, which will confirm this note is real. Because the FBI, they get a lot of false notes and warnings and threats. And so she's already kind of on their list of watch yourself, dear. So she's a little hesitant to go take this letter to her boss and say, what do you think of this? But she does. And how was he convinced that, well, maybe there is something to this threat?
First off, he knows that how good of an FBI agent she is and how much she hates it in the mailroom. So when she says, can I investigate this a little bit and just find out and speak to the detective that had the case, is when she realizes, that's when her boss gives her the green light to go check this out. And it's that initial step obviously leads to the rest of the book and all the things that happen. By giving her that permission, she starts to do investigating, and then step by step, the fire happens at the same place that the gentleman that did die. The proof that he did die is part of it. And then,
because it was his apartment building that burned.
It's his apartment
very
building.
Very suspicious. Right after he, in fact, he was dead when she got this letter, because he starts out by saying, I'm dead. And then also in this letter, this handwritten letter, is a passcode. And I just imagine, wow, you did some research about the technology as well as these places in Washington. And you have an expert in technology as one of the characters in your book. And she's also a woman.
Yes. I love women, okay?
And you give them nice roles.
Yes. Well-deserved. Well-deserved. She's a tech expert. I liked making up her name. In fact, I'm thinking of what is it? I can't remember.
Ashwini.
Yes.
I remember that because yes. It's I happen to have studied Sanskrit.
Okay.
And so that word jumped off the page at me. I thought, wow, where did he get that?
Well, names are a whole other thing about writing. When I first start writing, I always pick friends' names and just to as a placeholder. And then I go back and look for names that kind of fit the personality. And if you look up their names, you'll find out there are, you know, there's a saying about each name, you know, and from my Michael has its own connotations. So I go back and I do some research on that, just like I do on the computer technology stuff. I did not know all that. Quantum computing was new to me, but that's the fun of writing the book, is now I got to climb into.
You get to be an investigative reporter.
And
you investigate and report by putting it in your book.
And try to make it interesting and, you know, use comparisons. But thank goodness for the internet, because I can sit in my office and climb into the science of computing and climb in deep and then try to find the language that makes it work.
My guest is Michael Agliolo. It's an Italian name, and I have to remind myself to anglicize it, Agliolo.
That's how I knew my wife loved me.
She was willing to take on your name.
Yes, she did.
And this is his second novel, The 51st Directive. And there is such a thing as Directive 51, and this book unfolds. We learn more and more about this directive. Well, we meet FBI agent Erica Brewer. And then let's skip over to chapter 4 in your book, Michael. This is on page 21, and where and this is a realistic touch. Here's a woman. She lives by herself. She's probably not going to be very neat.
She's divorced.
Yeah, divorced. And so she comes home, and why don't you read us what her apartment's like?
Okay. I headed home, got to my apartment, took off my shoes and threw them into my bedroom on top of a pile of wadded-up clothes. I'm not the neatest gal you'll ever meet. I'd gone shopping 2 days earlier. I grabbed a hunk of cheese, a bag of chips, and poured a glass of wine into a tall beer mug. Plopped down, turned on the wizard game. The Warriors' point guard drove the lane and dropped in an uncontested 10-footer. "Get a center who can play some D," I yelled at my TV. By 9 o'clock, I'd had enough excitement, took a shower, and climbed into bed. Somewhere deep in my third REM cycle, my cell phone vibrated. My boss's name came on the screen. I'm a smart aleck in the morning and answered, "It's 6:45, boss. My letter opening time isn't until 8. A bomb exploded," he interrupted, 10 minutes ago in front of the White House. "Someone threw a backpack over the fence. Nobody's hurt, but the White House is shut down. The president's in the bunker, and there's a manhunt for the person caught on the surveillance cameras."
This is Michael Agliolo reading from his novel, The 51st Directive. So she refers to letter opening time. In other words, "Hey, boss, it's 6:45, and I don't have to go to the mailroom until 8. And then he says, well, this bomb exploded.
Yeah, the letters come true.
So this letter that she had was proving to be authentic. It wasn't a ruse. It wasn't a hoax, which is what they suspected. And so he tells her, "Get over here. You're off mail duty till further notice." So there she's out of the mailroom and goes back to her job that as being a detective. And she says she drops her pajamas on the floor and gets dressed. "I took my Glock from my gun safe." She said, "I hadn't needed it in the mailroom unless you count the times I wanted to shoot myself out of boredom." Now, you have guns playing a role in your novel.
Yes.
Do you know about guns?
No. I'm literally not a gun owner. And I can tell you right now, the friends that read my book early on straightened me out pretty good. Ted, if you're listening, I have some friends that are very smart about guns and very safe. And so they helped me work out all those details, because there is a lot of gunplay in here. More so than I would normally put in my a novel that I was writing in a different genre. But this, I think, required it, and I needed help. And that's where I got it from and learned how to, you know, I can load one now in my mind. I know how to, I could see it in my mind how you do it, even though I'm not someone that does that.
Well, this guy who starts his letter, "I am dead," is in possession. They find this gun that a civilian would not have been able to possess. So that's one of the mysteries, that how does this guy get this gun that he is not, who would be authorized to have such a gun, in fact?
Well, where he got it from is who's authorized, and that would be his brother, who runs an entire Marine encampment in down south, Pendleton,
Port
Camp
Pendleton.
So his brother is a commander, and that's where he got the gun, which is where this all leads.
Well, Erica doesn't know this. All she knows is in the letter, this guy named Brian says, only my brother knows where to find this particular flash drive that he refers to. And she says, he says, only my brother knows where to find this flash drive. And so she has to track down his brother to get the flash drive. And I thought it was interesting where this flash drive was hidden. Did you come up with that yourself?
Yes, or I did.
Do we dare tell people where it's hidden?
No, that's fine. I had to think about where would you hide something in an apartment that would not be easy to find. And so I took quite a while to figure that out. Open a door, and at the top of the door, drill a hole at the very top, and then put whatever you want inside it, like a jump drive. It's very small. It's only, you could put it in it and put a little cap back on of the same wood that you cut the hole, and you're probably not going to get found. But the brother knew that because that's where
when this brother comes from California, from Camp Pendleton, comes from California, goes to his brother's apartment, and since they had been brothers, he knew where to start looking. Mm-hmm. The others had looked everywhere they could think of. And, you know, sometimes people put, say, a key above the door frame, mm-hmm. but I don't think anybody would think mm-hmm. to look inside the door itself.
I didn't either. That's why I'm going to hide everything, of course. And he knew that because they grew up together, and that's where, as brothers, the brother that died, that's where he hid things from his dad. We'll leave those alone.
Well, I mentioned this tech-savvy woman mm-hmm. that Erica relies on.
Shreya.
She calls her up Shreya. Mm-hmm. And Shreya says, yeah, I'll help you out, but I want something in return. And what does Shreya want?
A drink, a dinner. They're friends. So that's all she ever wants is the little social contact.
And probably not just a drink from the way you describe her.
Yeah, she definitely likes, she's only 5 foot tall, but she can fill up her empty leg, which is part of her character.
Well, you refer to a restaurant in your book, and this is in chapter 17, Mike. You have these two friends playing a game that a lot of us like to play. I have to admit, you know, you get on a subway or an airplane, and you have these two characters go to this restaurant. Where did you get the name of this restaurant? There's such
I made
a restaurant.
It up. Made it up. The Fat Angel.
The Fat Angel, yeah. So the Fat Angel restaurant. So why don't you read that from your book?
Okay. If Jesus ever makes a comeback to Earth, he's going to find exactly what he's looking for at the Fat Angel restaurant in D.C. Great food and a room full of sinners. The restaurant was packed when we arrived. We took the last two seats at the bar, ordered gin and tonics, and asked for menus. Shreya powered down two tonics before I'd finished my first. I hadn't eaten since this morning and been running on caffeine, and the gin was tickling my brain. We ordered dinner at the bar and started guessing what the other people in the restaurant did for a living. It's a game we play. It's dumb, offensive, and we should be ashamed of ourselves. I love it.
This is Michael Agliolo. He's reading from his second novel, The 51st Directive. And I don't want to go too far in your book because there are too many surprises that we don't want to spoil for your readers. Is there anything else you would like to add so that we don't give any surprises
away? Oh, let's spoil it. the story goes quite a bit further. I think it's one of the things that I knew as I wrote, like I told you, I don't really know what's going to come next, but I really wanted to write a military scene. And I wanted it to be our military against our military.
Yeah, because I didn't see anywhere in your background that you yourself had been in the military.
No.
So maybe that's all the more reason it fascinated you.
Maybe. All I knew is that I thought that would be an interesting, that would be fun to write. See, that's what I keep doing, is I keep going to the next thing that I think is going to be fun to write. The bar scene, the next scene that happens in the bread truck. I mean, all the things are what I think would be a fun thing to watch in a movie or to experience. So the Army against the Marines was a fun thing to write, especially since they both are like the Air Force, have jets. And I wanted – that was always a fascination of mine, were jets when I was a kid. So I brought that out too. And I got to use the dialogue of pilots speaking to other pilots. And so I think that's one of the things I like to point out that does happen, which is I haven't seen that too often in a movie. So I felt pretty original about how it came about.
So this is much like a movie. It's quite visual. You have the dialogue like you might find in a movie. But again, I'm reluctant to spoil any of the surprises in your book. But you're welcome to, if you have anything else you want to add.
Well, I think just putting that in, and hopefully there's all the surprises are surprises, including the main plot, which has to do with the Capitol and has to do with 51st Directive. That's what this is all about, and how scary that can be. So I try to keep the tone light through her eyes, through a woman's eyes that kept coming back to her personality, but at the same time keep the story moving to its conclusion, which hopefully you didn't know was going to happen until we got there.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, this has been fun. Thank you.
My guest has been Michael Agliolo, and his second novel is The 51st Directive. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk to screenwriter Michael Tabb, who will be in Chico April 27th for the creative writing conference WordSpring. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm back with my guest, Michael Tabb, who is a screenwriter and written a book, Pre-Writing Your Screenplay, A Step-by-Step Guide to Generating Stories. Screenwriter Michael Tabb attended USC, received a BFA from NYU, and did postgraduate work at UCLA's School of Film and Television. He has developed projects for Disney Feature Animation and other entertainment companies. He refers to his early experiences as a crash course in how the industry of Hollywood filmmaking really works. Michael Tabb has written articles about tricks to his screenwriting process, and he wrote a book, Pre-Writing Your Screenplay, A Step-by-Step Guide to Generating Stories. He will be in Chico at the invitation of Butte College as a presenter in the creative writing conference WordSpring, which takes place April 27th. Michael Tabb, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I didn't mention, but you are co-founder of a mentor program that is a part of WGA. And for people who aren't familiar with that, what is WGA?
Okay, in the movie industry, there are different unions to represent different kinds of artists and businessmen. There's the PGA for producers, there's SAG-AFTRA for actors, and for writers, there's the WGA, which is the Writers Guild of America. It's separated into two coasts. There's a Writers Guild West and a Writers Guild East. Each covers their side of the Mississippi River. I'm a decade-long member of the Writers Union for movies and motion pictures and television and radio. And I love being a member, and they do a lot for us. But one of the things that I remembered growing up or coming up in this business is that there are a lot of touchy situations, and this business is very much about relationships, especially if you want to work in television, and you can't poison your writer's room at work or your development room working on a movie by making anything awkward, because that's a great way to get removed from a project. So I always felt that it would have been wonderful if the union had put together something that allowed writers to speak to writers who have been in that situation before. So screenwriters can talk to people who've other people who've written movies and have succeeded and continue to work in this town and ask them, hey, did you come across this type of a situation or not? And it talks so that you have somebody to turn to so that you don't mess up your relationships in the office. You can talk to other writers and powwow your problems you're having so you can find ways of solving them without upsetting the apple cart at all.
So this inspired you to create this mentor program.
Yes, they were revamping the new members committee, and David Shore, who runs House, who ran the TV show House, he's a head writer on that and showrunner, and then he now does The Good Doctor. Brilliant, brilliant writer. Took me to lunch one day with my friend Clifford Green, who's another writer in the WGA, and because we had helped with that. That committee before, he asked us if we had any thoughts as to how to make it better. And my immediate thing, the whole thing I prepared for that meeting, was to talk to him about the idea of creating a mentor program so that the first 2 years you come into the Guild as a fresh writer, you have somebody to turn to so that you don't make any business mistakes.
Well, what you're doing when you come to Chico sounds like somewhat of an extension of this idea of helping out the newcomer, because you're going to be doing, I understand, a workshop about writing screenplays. Is that the case?
Yeah, it's going to focus mainly on generating story ideas. It's the process that I use that my book is based on. That takes you from absolutely not having any idea what you want to write next and can help you come up with an idea by basing it on something that you truly believe. And then it works you through the process of developing characters and putting that into structure so that you can create a story from absolutely nothing. And that's what I'll be teaching while I'm there. I also am part of the Writers Education Committee, which is also at the Writers Guild of America, and I've been on that for over a decade. I love to give back. I love to teach. I've guest lectured at USC, NYU, UCLA, Florida State. You know, it's a pleasure to me. I believe that we will never make our craft better if the people who know what they're doing don't teach everything they know and everything they've learned to the younger people coming up so that they can take what we know and then take it further in their lifetime.
My guest is Michael Tabb, and he is a screenwriter who will be in Chico at the invitation of Butte College to give a workshop on generating ideas, generating stories. And mm-hmm. Your book is entitled A Step-by-Step Guide to Generating Stories. And you also call it pre-writing your screenplay. So,
yeah.
What do you mean by that?
It's pre-writing your screen. You know, people say there's writing and then there's rewriting. Well, there's a step before all that. Pre-writing is everything you do and all the things you should prep and think about and prepare and make notes for yourself on before you actually write Fade In. Now, Fade In is the movie version of In the Beginning or Once Upon a Time. Old screenplays, we actually don't use it much anymore. They've started to not use it. But Fade In is the first thing you write on the top of page one to get you started in screenplays. So before you start writing the script, this takes you through the whole process of how to build a fully flushed out story suited into the genre that it fits, inhabit it with characters that have very specific purposes so that your point can be made, and then outline it and put it into a form with great structure, with fabulous build, and take it to a climactic ending. And then the last bit of it, the book, and I'll mention it in the speaking series, is once you learn how to create nothing into something, at the end of the book, it shows you what happens if you do have an idea for something you want to write, but you haven't figured it all out yet. It shows you how to reverse engineer everything you need into the story. So sometimes people will just get an idea, you know, I want to do an athletic film on skydiving in the Antarctic, you know, and it's like, I could see a lot of visuals there. It's going to be fun. There's all this ice and then they get stranded or whatever, you know, somebody might have an idea for something way out there we've never seen before. It's like, okay, now what's it really about? And through the technique that I use, it shows you how to reverse engineer from seeing the surface of what it is you want to create and dig down to the core of it and then build it back out from the center.
Well, I read so many books that even local writers that are so visual that I get caught up in the story so that I can just see it playing on a screen as I sit there reading it. And I think, wow, this would make such a good movie. But that is so rare that somebody's book, no matter how good it is, makes it into even a screenplay form.
Yeah, it's really about figuring out how much you can fit into 2 hours and 120 pages. Because a book, you can go on and you have all these things and you don't have time to set everything up. And you have to figure out when you adapt a book to a screenplay, you have to make some very tough choices. And you have to decide what covers what it is you're trying to say and what things, though you may love them in the book, you have to get rid of because it just won't all fit. And I think people write more visually now than they ever have because everybody now is raised on movies and television. And we're used to hearing and seeing stories told in that way. So it makes a lot of sense that people, the more modern we get, the more people are writing movies and stories or just stories and books in a far more visual fashion because that's how we see stories told lately. That's the predominant method of storytelling, at least for our marketplace. Even kids, before the kids can read, we teach them to read young. But before that, you put them in front of a TV and they watch something. It's just how stories are told now. It used to be we would read kids' stories, and I still read my kids' stories. And then they would learn to read, and that would be the thing. But now, you know, we're raised on television and movie theaters, and I think it makes all storytelling far more visual because we're used to picturing story.
Well, it sounds like it's more unusual than not for a person to need to hire a screenwriter to convert their book into something visual because there sounds like different talents that the person may be able to write a good book, but not necessarily a good screenplay.
Absolutely. Half of my jobs have been adaptations. Whether it's somebody having me adapt a book, or I've been asked to adapt an idea from a toy into a movie. I've been given sequels and prequels and reinventing an IP, an intellectual property that was once a set of stories and trying it in a different way nowadays. The art of turning it into formatting on a script is a lot more difficult than people give it credit for, and it's a lot simpler than people think it is. It's just you got to figure out where the scene is located, then you got to describe all the action of what we see and the dialogue of everything you hear so that it flows well, so that it moves quickly. What you're doing is giving them the nuts and bolts of story, and then you're going to give them all the hints that they need to be able to understand the weight of the emotional and physical conflict that's going on in the story and how it escalates. You're not the final say. Somebody's going to come in and create the sets. I mean, the books were incredible, like the Harry Potter series. But, you know, there's a lot that happened when they took it and made it into a film that took it beyond what anybody thought it was and made it different and special just as a movie. And they had to create those worlds. And in the book, you had all these descriptions, but in the script you can't over describe things and say there's this store and there's that store, but then somebody has to come in and give it a visual style, you know? And so everybody who works on a film plays an important part of creating the final vision. It's not just the writer's job to do that. So you have to know what to put in there and what not to, and how much time you have and how to space it out. And a lot of times you have to get rid of things you really love so that it works as a film. It's hard. It's hard stuff.
My guest is Michael Tabb. He is a screenwriter, and he will be in Chico April 27th to give a workshop on a step-by-step guide to generating stories when you want to write a screenplay. Now, Michael, you had academic preparation for your career. You did work at UCLA School of Film and Television. Did you find that you could walk out the door with your degree and then go right to work, or did you find that you had preparation that you didn't you needed to arrange for yourself?
You're always learning. I don't know if any school really prepares any person completely for a career, because three quarters of what you always learn is doing it in person there. It's funny, the first script I ever wrote that got me into UCLA as a student wound up being the first thing I ever set up. And it got set up with this amazing actor and a two-time Oscar-winning Dustin Hoffman and Mike Newell, who directed Four Weddings and a Funeral. And speaking of Harry Potter, he did The Goblet of Fire. And he's this amazing British director. He did Donnie Brasco. Great, great people. And but the amount of time between when I wrote that script and when somebody picked it up, that was like 7 years.
Oh, my goodness.
My first paycheck on writing a movie wasn't until I had written 17 feature films. And I'd done that in those 7 years. I try to crank out about three original pieces of material a year. If you're able to spend all your time doing that, you can, if you have another job, then you have to figure out and find time to, you know, to get that done. I was fortunate. I had, I was supported during those years, so I could just crank out material.
You were also fortunate to catch the eye of somebody like Dustin Hoffman.
Yes. Yeah, it's pretty shocking. He just won an Oscar a couple years before, and it was mind blowing. But the script caught his eye, but it was the agency that gave him the script. You know, I didn't always have representation. Obviously, when I came out to LA, I needed to find someone. I met somebody in a social situation, actually, not too ironically, at a Jewish temple, because people, you know, talk about how there are a lot of Jewish people in Hollywood. And it's funny. I met someone at a Jewish temple, going to synagogue, on Friday Shabbos, which is where I'm going tonight. And, he said, let me read the script. And I gave it to him, and he gave it to someone else who was a manager. And that person loved it and said, hey, I want to show it to a couple people. She showed it to a couple producers. One of them called me into their office and said, hey, do you mind if I show this to an agent? So all this is happening just because one piece of material hits one person, and then they show it to somebody and they like it. And then they show it to somebody and they like it, because people want to pass on good material. They want good things to happen. They want to see it happen for you. If people don't want to share, pass on your material, chances are the material needs some work. So it got passed, and then they sent it to the top three agencies. The production company sent it to the top three agencies in Hollywood. The next day, one of those agents called me, my manager, and said, we want them.
So it helps to be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, well, of course. Absolutely. And then they gave it to both. It was funny. They gave the script to both the director and the actor at the same time, thinking one of them would like it and then one of them would want to make it. The problem was is that they both liked the script so much, they both wanted to control it. And there became some harsh words. And when the script went to one party, the other party left the agency but still stayed on the project. Because they wanted the project. They didn't want it to go to the other company at the agency. And they felt the agency took sides against them.
Well, another, I think, dream that a lot of young people getting into the business have, a dream of working for Disney. I mean, that sounds too good to be true, too. And you developed projects for Disney feature animation, Michael.
That was an amazing experience. I worked with Lindsay Hughes and Mary Jane Buckley over there. And that was my first job creating something from scratch for a studio. And they wanted me to do this adaptation of Mr. Popper's Penguins. which is an adorable story by the Atwells, from the 1930s. And they were really supportive. They told me what they wanted. I went away. I created something. They loved it. And then, unfortunately, what happens with these situations, Hollywood is a bunch of politics. And you have to be very careful everywhere you go and who you talk to and what you do, which is why creating the mentor program was so important. Well, in this situation, the person who was running the project that I worked on for them was Roy Disney. And he was the last Disney to be running to really be running with the Disney name, running Disney, the production entity, the studio. And when somebody else was elected over him to the top position, they basically booted him out. And when somebody gets booted out of from the top of the company, when Roy was asked to leave, all the projects that were his got thrown on a shelf. Because nobody wants to create something in their regime that they weren't responsible and can't take credit for. So that project never got made. And then the option on the original material went back into turnaround. It got picked up by Fox, and they made a live action version of the movie with Jim Carrey.
You know, I think a lot of what you're saying applies not to just your industry and your field, but I remember a professor who was denied tenure, and the chairman said, "Well, you just didn't politic."
That's right. Everybody's ego needs coddling, and everything is. It's amazing how much is relationships, and there are only so many spots for things. And if you want one of those rare spots for things, you have to know how to treat everybody involved and make it so that that you are undeniable. You would think it would be enough to have talent or be good at your job. It's not these days. It's not like that anymore. Nowadays, there are more people than jobs. And if you want to keep your job, you have to do more than your job in order to keep it and get into a position of tenure or to be able to write big movies. You've got to serve the people who you're working for. And if you don't show complete loyalty and you're not top of the game, then you're just not going to get ahead.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Michael, about the workshop that you're going to be doing. We will look forward to meeting you on April 27th. Thanks, Michael.
I can't wait to have you guys out there. Thank you so much.
My guest is Michael Tabb, and he wrote a book, Pre-Writing Your Screenplay, A Step-by-Step Guide to Generating Stories.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.